intimate group, right? My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I really appreciate being asked to be a speaker in this cadre of speakers that you've selected. I've traveled a lot and listened to a lot of speakers. I've heard slick ones. I've heard good ones. I've heard people who didn't walk like they talked. And I've never heard Walt talk. But I can tell you, if my intuition is correct, you're in for a real treat tomorrow. And I know the two speakers that we heard, one last night, my wife, and Jeanette today, they just don't get any better. You know, it's interesting. It's really enjoyable to hear AA speakers and Al-Anon speakers who just give a talk, you know? No flash, no bells and whistles, just honest to God, experience strength and hope. And it was just a joy for me to hear that. Jim, Mickey, thank y'all for putting our names in the pot and letting us come. Thanks for letting us come to your homecoming, your family reunion. Because it's obvious that's what this place means to so many of y'all. I was here 5 years ago and talked, and that may say a lot about the memory retention of those people who selected me this time, but and they're getting older too, you know, and thinking gets real flaky at times, but changes have occurred, and some of the people who were here at that time are just not here this time, and that made me sad. I talked about it Thursday night. But for you people who've been here 20 and 25 and 30 years, these walls really talk, don't they? Y'all have seen a whole legion of people who have walked through here, and your memories must be incredible, you know? And I am just grateful to be here and share in those memories with y'all, to be a part of that thing. What I really feel is a deep sense of gratitude to you people who stood up to the line and kept AA intact for me. Because there are many of you in this room that did just that. I'm not talking about just the people from Louisville that I know. I'm talking about those people for those 30 years that stood up to the line and kept AA intact so that it would be here for me, and it'd be here for my wife, and it'd be here for my son, and it'd be here for my daughter, and it'd be here for my brother. And what I feel is a deep sense of responsibility, that light, lovely mantle that God puts on each of us of responsibility to be damn sure that heritage is passed on. I don't know if I can leave AA any better than when I came in, because it seems to be pretty good just the way it is, but I'd sure as hell like to be able to leave it the way I found it. And to that I make a commitment, not just tonight, but to those of you who stood up to the line. Okay? And I thank you for it. As the years have gone by, my memory starts to slip. And basically, I'm still okay about, I can add and subtract. And I figured out how the zipper, I can still remember how the zipper works, and that's fortunate. But I'm forgetting names. Names just are terrible, you know, they're just terrible. I really appreciate John introducing me. Now, I told him tonight before he introduced me, I said, John, don't be nervous about this. You're just going to be given a wonderful opportunity standing in front of 100 of your closest friends and make a complete fool of yourself, so don't worry about it. But you did great. I appreciate it. Thanks. We did have a good time today. We really did, and I appreciate that. But I've gotten where I can't remember names, and I always tell this joke, and I tell this joke because it's funny, but I also tell this joke because it gets me off the hook. When I can't remember names. And there was this old priest, he was 95 years old, and his mind was still razor sharp. I mean, just razor sharp. He could remember everything except he couldn't remember names. So he figured out a way to do it. He'd write down names on the inside lapel of his coat, and as he would talk, he'd refer to those names on the inside lapel of his coat. So they'd ask him to give the retirement dinner for one of his closest friends, a 70-year-old priest who had retired. And he got up there in front of the group that night, and he said, I am really deeply grateful to be here at this retirement dinner for this friend of mine for lo these many years, that he has been such a friend of mine, this dear friend of mine, Father James O'Reilly. who has been the parish priest of this, my favorite parish, this parish that has meant so much to me throughout my life, this parish that is my favorite parish, this parish of St. Michael. He said, but most of all, I want to tell you how grateful I am for those years that Father labored long and hard in the vineyards of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So if tonight during my talk I go in here and say, Jesus Christ, you know I've lost it. And I got to tell you, I've been known to lose it before, right in the middle of it. I mean right in the middle of it. I've just been out to lunch and gone somewhere, and that's the way it is. I gave a talk over in southern Indiana in Jeffersonville, and in fact, Token Club, and I walked in. I normally don't go there, but I'm, you know, been asked to speak there when I get back home sometime in December. It's a 10 o'clock meeting, but this didn't have to be a 10 o'clock meeting. But in any event, going to Jeffersonville, which is right across the river from Louisville, you know everybody. Everybody just knows everybody. It's going day A, but I don't normally go to that meeting, and they know if I'm coming, I'm going to speak at a birthday. So I walked in the back door. One of the guys said, are you talking tonight? And I said, yeah. And he said, keep it honest and keep it short. I said, well, I'm not sure I can do both. He said, then keep it short. Now, I got to tell you, going in, for those people who've ever listened to me talk, you know it probably ain't going to be short. I have a tendency to get long-winded. I quit drinking coffee because of that, because that made it even worse. And you know, after you, when I get through tonight, you're going to say, thank God he isn't drinking coffee anymore. But I tell you, it will be honest. And I do need to clear a couple of things up for young people in this program. I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I'm not going to tell you it's the right way, the only way, or the best way to recover. I'm going to tell you what happened to me. And some of it I would not recommend anybody do, and some of it I'd recommend everybody do. When I was early in AA and they had a speaker, especially one of these speakers that came in from out of town, and I was real early in AA, I figured that speaker had the truth. And if I'd listen to that speaker and do just what he or she said, then I would know exactly what I was supposed to do to stay sober. And I mean, I'd just sit there and I'd listen to Clancy and I'd listen to Sandy Beach and I'd listen to Jim Hawk. I'd listen to those guys and I'd get all gutted down. I'd listen to Bob Wilson. I think if I'd do just what they do, I'd try to do what they do. And I got goofier than a damn snake because they were in a different spot from me. There's some of you who are exactly where I am tonight. There's some of you who are striving to get there. There's some of you who are beyond that. I don't know. It's just always a spectrum of constantly changing. And what I'm going to say to you, if you can use, please take it. If it doesn't make any sense to you, talk to me about it when it's over, and I'll share with you maybe some things I didn't explain well. Maybe you can share some things with me. But that's what the whole deal's about. I will tell you one thing. There have been places I have not been asked to speak because parts of my story were found to be objectionable to certain people. I have one major asset, and the book taught me that. It's my experience. I deeply, deeply want to tell anybody in this room who may not appreciate parts of my story, it is done with the deepest reverence to this program and the sanctity of it and the spirituality of it. But I've come to know through prayer and through sharing with my sponsor, I will not omit any of my story. God gave it to me, and I will use it to share with anyone who may be able to use it too. I simply cannot omit anything. Please accept that with deepest humility. It is not a challenge. I'm not saying I'm going to make anybody mad, because I don't think I will. But I do know that I have a major asset. It's my experience. And God gave me every minute of it. I'm told that I have a peculiar mental condition. Big Book tells me I have a peculiar mental condition. Well, that peculiar mental condition for an alcoholic, at least for this, is to figure out some way that I can get back and take a drink. Now, it's never intended to be that. It can be ex-wives, country clubs, all kinds of deals. But that peculiar mental condition will get me back to that point in time where I can justify taking a drink. What an incredible side street that it takes many times to get back to that point in time where I can say I will do the one thing that is absolutely predictable in that it will kill me. And to be able to justify that, that peculiar mental condition that involves all of life that gets back to the alcoholic seminal issue is saying I can drink again. We were very fortunate being down in Beaumont, Texas, and here in at a conference center. Jim and Mickey were there, and there was an old gentleman there named Damon. He had 85 years. He's 85 years old, has about 40 years of sobriety. And he told a joke that is the alcoholic's epitome joke. I mean, this is the alcoholic joke about peculiar mental condition. There's this traveling salesman traveled East Texas. He'd run around from town to town to town. He'd stay there a week, and he had a terrible drinking problem. When he'd check into the motel, he'd stay drunk. And they'd just set him up every night because he knew he was going to get drunk, and they'd have everything in there for him. Next day, he'd go out and do his job, come back in, check in the motel that night, and they'd set him up the same way every night. Well, one time he left this town. We'll say it's Longview. He'd had about, like a lot of us, he'd had all this fun he could tolerate. So he decided to get into AA. So he got into AA, and they didn't know this, and a month later he comes back through, circulating through this traveling salesman job, checked into the motel, and went out that night to go to an AA meeting, and they thought he was going out to get drunk like he always did, so they set him up like they always set him up. So he comes back in that night after his meeting and after supper, and he opens the room, and when he opens the room, he turns on the light, and sure enough, they've got him set up. Here's a quart of whiskey sitting on the bedside table, and two beautiful women sitting on the foot of the bed. And he sat there and looked at the whole scene for a minute. He said, I want y'all to know that I have gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and I asked them what I had to do to stay sober and be happy. And they told me that if I wanted to stay sober, I couldn't drink. And if I wanted to be happy, I'd have to change everything I'm doing. He said, so I'm not going to be able to drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. Is there one alcoholic in this room that can't relate to that? Now, I don't know how much half measures availed him, but the whole deal was that that's the peculiar mental condition. We'll compromise with God. We will negotiate with anything to get the deal, you know? To get the deal. That's the peculiar mental condition. I had a guy one time tell me that he treated his mind like a bad neighborhood. He never went in there alone. And that may not, y'all may not relate that. I can, because that's what's going off all the time in there. You know, all that noise and all that deal. Never go in there alone. You know, what I found out through the years is the foundation of that peculiar mental condition for me is fear. The big book in the 12 and 12 calls it self-centered fear. But long before I knew about self-centered, I sure as hell knew fear. It dominated me for as long as I can remember. When I walked out of the treatment center, they said to me, Burns, how do you feel? And I said, I am absolutely scared to death. And they said, are you scared you're going to get drunk or drug? And I said, no. Y'all told me what to do, not to do that. You told me to go home and get in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd teach me a way that I wouldn't have to get drunk or take drugs. And they said, what are you afraid of? And I said, I'm afraid I'm just going to screw it up. They said, screw what up? And I said, I don't know. Just screw it up. All of my life I've been dominated by that fear of I'm going to screw it up. Translated into its essence for me, it was the deep abiding fear of inadequacy. What the big book says, it's a fear of the failure of my own self-reliance. And based on my self-reliance, all I have ever felt was an impending doom of when would I fail. I was afraid I couldn't be a doctor. I was afraid I couldn't be a good husband. I was afraid I couldn't be a good father. I was afraid I couldn't be a good human being. I was afraid I couldn't be a good athlete. Constant fear. And what I found in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I am inadequate. Alone. I have found in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 16 years. My sobriety date's December the 1st, 1977. And I found in those 16 years that there has not been one single thing that you and I and God cannot handle. It's been bloody sometimes. It's been joyful sometimes. But it's sure as hell been worth the trip. And there's not been one single thing that you and I and God cannot handle. And without you and God with me, I have proved to be inadequate on a repetitive basis. I'm a doctor. For 25 years, I practiced family medicine in Louisville. During that 25 years, I guess I saw about every disease there is to see. I enjoyed family practice. I left 2 years ago to take on another job. And it's been one of the losses that I've had in a series of two or three losses in the last three or four years. And I'm having to look at that in depth, and we talked about that somewhat Thursday night. I'm so grateful for those 25 years. During those 25 years, I had close relationships with so many people. In primary care medicine, you just get that way. You bury the grandparents, and you bury some of the ones that are my age, and you birth their babies, and you raise them, and then you birth their grandbabies, and then you raise them. And in 25 years, I got real close to those people, and I saw just about everything there was to see. About every disease there is to see. I can't think of a one I missed, unless it was some esoteric disease from Africa or God knows where. But I never saw one disease that even closely approximates in its severity and its intensity and its destruction, the disease of alcoholism. Not one, not close. Not one, not close. It takes everybody prisoner and salvages none. It takes everybody prisoner and salvages none. I've only found one power strong enough to deal with a disease of the magnitude of alcoholism, and that's the power of love. If there's a one word synonymous with Alcoholics Anonymous for me, it's love. When I was a little boy in Western Kentucky, in Mayfield, I'd sit there and 5 years old in Sunday school kindergarten, swinging in that little swing, and they'd say to me, God is love, God is love, God is love, God is love. And it just became so entrenched in me. When I came to you people in 1977, the third step was smoke and mirrors to me, not rejected. It had no form. The third step is an abstract concept. Believe it or not, it's an abstract concept. You heard Casey talk about it last night. And we have sawdust for brains for about 2 years. And it's a medical fact we cannot deal in abstract concepts. It's not a matter of willpower. It's a matter of we can't do it. And when I'd get to that third step, I would want desperately to let it be mine. And I didn't know how, but what I could say is, God is love. God is love. And it took about 2 years for that to go from God is love to being willing to turn my life and my will over to a power greater than myself. The principle of love of Alcoholics Anonymous does not change. The face of Alcoholics Anonymous is changing. In the brief 16 years I've been here, I've seen it change rather dramatically. Many of you are familiar with Geraldine Delaney, a wonderful lady from New Jersey. She's about, I guess, 90 years old now, been sober close to 50 years. And I asked her in 1987, I said, has Alcoholics Anonymous changed since you came in? She didn't even break a second. She said, yes. I said, how? And she said, Burns, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, there were at least 20 old-timers for every newcomer. She said, today there's probably 20 to 40 newcomers for every old-timer. She said, we've got people with 1 and 2 and 3 years of sobriety sponsoring newcomers. She said, that's not a judgment, that's a report. And as a matter of fact, it's the blessings that go with Alcoholics Anonymous, but along with it go deep responsibilities. And those responsibilities are those of us who've been around long enough need to be damn sure that we preserve the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous because the personalities are changing. I said, Ms. Delaney, what are the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous? And she said, they are contained in the first 164 pages of the big book. And those are the ones we must preserve. I became deeply aware of that commitment. I go to 5 AA meetings a week, and 2 of those are always big book studies. As I continue to learn the depth of new sentences that I've read hundreds of times as I continue to carry that message to those young people who want to hear it. That the real issue of Alcoholics Anonymous is not Burns Brady's personality. The issue is the first 164 pages of the Big Book and the 12 steps, and more than just the 12 steps, the rest of those pages. My program has gone to a whole different level, and I am feeling real good about the fact I'm helping other people's program to go to a new level. The face of Alcoholics Anonymous is changing. We look on our AA clubs and our clubs that we have. And what is the face of AA, the wonderful face of AA that we see where there are these two men with suits on in this magnificent 12-step endeavor, sitting beside the bed, talking to a man in a t-shirt. They're making a beautiful 12-step call. That was the face of AA, two men talking to a man. When we were at Beaumont, which was a very powerful conference for me, God was sending me a bunch of stuff, and I realized how powerful it was today. I saw the new face of AA. On Saturday morning, I got up, 7 o'clock in the morning, going through my meditation. I looked out at this little pool at this motel, and beside this pool, the only two people there were two little girls, 15 years old. Sitting beside this pool, there was a table beside them. They had a big book on this table and a meditation book. And they were sitting in chairs facing each other. And they were holding each other's hands like this. And their eyes would be closed. And one of them's lips would move. And then the other one's lips would move. And then they would stop. And they would reach over. And they would open that big book, another page. And they would read. And then they'd go back and hold each other's hands. And they were obviously praying, reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The face had changed. Two little girls. The principle's the same. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Loving each other. Thank God the children are coming. And thank God the women are coming. Because if the children weren't coming, I would have two of them dead. And we were able to open our arms. I never shy away from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because there's a bunch of irritating adolescents. And are they adolescent and are they irritating? But thank God we're big enough to take them in and hug them and love them. Because those adolescents will one day be the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we have a responsibility, and I feel it again, it's to be sure that they know those principles. Most of them will tell you they love to play together. But they left to be with us to learn how to live. You know, to learn how to live. Since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've found some things that have simply not changed since the first day I came in. They just simply have not changed. The first thing that has not changed for me is that I'm constantly changing. I'm constantly changing. I'm not the same person I was 5 years ago. Nobody in this room is the same person they were 5 years ago if they were here. People call this different plateaus of growth. I don't relate to different plateaus of growth. I relate to it intellectually. What I relate to at a feeling level is they've been different plateaus of surrender, where I have surrendered to God's absolute power and my powerlessness. And even the act of surrender has been different through the years. I surrendered to alcohol because it whipped me. I surrendered to my sponsor because I was scared not to. I surrendered to going to meetings because I didn't want to get drunk. Then I surrender to God's love because I've, and this, all this is over the years, and the different mechanisms of surrender change as I change. What used to be a solution for me in Alcoholics Anonymous was if a square peg won't fit in a round hole, get a bigger hammer. And today that principle of surrender is contained in the sixth and seventh step. Whole different concept, but again, a surrender to the absolute magnificent power of God and my limited power. I used to listen to people like Bob. I didn't hear Bob say it, but there were people of his era in Louisville, and somebody would get drunk. And I would say, what happened? And they would say, well, they didn't understand or they didn't accept the first step. And I thought that meant they didn't accept their powerlessness over alcohol. It took me some years to recognize what they didn't accept was that their life was unmanageable. They were still driving that square peg in that round hole. They were still driving that square peg in that round hole. And it'd simply take what it took. And it took me getting my nose bloodied over and over and over. But I knew one thing. I'd keep coming back. And I surrendered to God's power and my limited power. And what I got in return from you people. And see, God talks to me directly. He just sounds like you. You know? And what I got back from you people is, yeah, God has the power, but you got the responsibility. If you want the whole deal, do the whole deal. If you want 50% of the program, do 50% of the program, Burns. If you want 100% of the program, do 100% of the program. I had no problem with not drinking and going to meetings. But I lived the first 8.5 years in this program on a 3 1/3 step program. I had the first 3 steps and a third of the 12th step. And I took more people. I went and made more 12-step calls. I didn't notch my belt. My sponsor told me if I wanted to stay sober, I had to help other people stay sober. And I went and got those people, and I drug them to treatment centers. I took them to meetings. I helped them. I was right there on the firing line, and I am absolutely sure today it kept me sober. But after 8.5 years in this program, I was goofier than a damn snake. I mean, I was goofy. I was goofy. And that's when, driven by a whole set of circumstances, I became an absolute student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read it. I took it into my head. I did it. It went into my heart, and I lived by it. And I got to tell you, as my experience, a 3 1/3 step program ain't anywhere close to a 12-step program. There's a difference in daylight and dark. The last 7 years of my life have been entirely different from the first eight, in recovery, have been entirely different from the first 8.5 years. People come into me all the time and say, when I was practicing medicine, I was known as the alcoholic doctor. Not because I was an alcoholic, because all alcoholics came to me. And I saw the whole myriad of depressions. You know, the first 2 year depression where we're detoxifying, then the 5 year depression where we make this surrender, then the 10 and 12 year depression where people decide they can do it on their own, then the 20 and 25 year depression where they get bigger than the process. You see the whole deal, and I saw this whole depression. People come in and say, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why do I feel like this? And I'd sit down, you got a sponsor? Well, yeah. When's the last time you talked to him? About a month ago. You going to meetings? Yeah. How many are you going to? Well, I used to go to 7, now I'm going to 3. When's the last time you read the big book? Oh, I think about a month ago, maybe 2. I tell you, this alcoholic, without having the whole deal, gets goofy as a snake, depressed. Depressed. My responsibility. Second thing that's not changed for me is that I'm powerless over alcohol. Alcohol whipped me. Alcohol whipped me. I started taking amphetamine in 1958, my freshman year in medical school. I took amphetamine for 12 years with no alcohol. During that period of time, I got kicked out of medical school. I was in the mental hospital 4 times, strapped down, IV fluid, straight jackets, almost got put in Leavenworth in the Army. 1970, I quit taking amphetamine, but I didn't quit taking amphetamine because I was powerless over it. I quit taking amphetamine because I wanted all those people off my butt. I got tired of them putting me in mental hospitals. I got tired of them running around blowing smoke up my butt, and I quit taking amphetamine because I wanted them off my back. Now, I didn't think in terms of powerless or off my back. I just knew, I saw that if I quit taking the drug, people quit hawking me. So, you know, I figured it out. I was real intuitive after 12 years. I figured it out. Quit taking the drug and they'll get off of me. Then I drank for 8 years and I really ended up in a sewer drinking. And when I ended up in my bottom with alcohol, alcohol whipped me. I looked around at the carnage of people all around me and couldn't stand that anymore. Mom and Daddy, the looks in their eyes, my partner, Casey, my first wife, my children. I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't stand the line anymore. I didn't care whether I ever practiced another day of medicine. I didn't care whether I ever belonged to another country club. All I wanted was somebody to take me and show me how not to drink whiskey and bring me back to some dignity. It whipped me. Left me nothing. Third thing that's not changed in my life since I've been in this program is that it would take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity. Now, it took a power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of drinking. For the last 10 years or last 12 years of my recovery, I've studied our disease extensively. All it does is enhance what Dr. Silkworth said, we have a physical allergy and a mental obsession. But there are all kinds of wonderful formulas today, and we know a ton today, which is proving what Dr. Silkworth said. And I travel all over the country, especially in Kentucky, teaching doctors how to treat us. And what I've got to tell you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic and ever being able to drink like a normal person. You ain't going to be able to do it. It just ain't going to work. Yeah, it took that power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of drinking. And I need to tell you, for this alcoholic, I must never forget that. But it's taken a power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of sobriety. Because once I quit drinking, you know what I was left with? I was left with the problem. You know what the problem is? It's me. It's me. And it's taken that power to... the only excuse I've got for some of the dumb things I've done sober is self-centeredness. And the book defined it for me. Let me give you an example. About 3 years ago, I was walking down the hall of my office. I'd had a patient to come in. The gal up in the front office had pulled the chart. She was an hour late in pulling the chart. The nurse in the back didn't get it in time. When she didn't take the blood pressure, she didn't take the pulse. So I was 2 hours late getting in to see this patient. Patient just chewed me out. Just ate me alive. Should have. I stood there and took it in my spiritual best manner. Then I walked out in the hall and called both those girls back and did the only thing you can do under those conditions. I fired them. As they turned around and walked off, I'm sitting there thinking, Burns, you've lost your friggin' mind. And I thought, how long have I got to deal with this insatiable ego? You know, now I'm not talking about the kind of ego that wants to go skydiving naked at the Super Bowl, you know? And there's not one alcoholic in this room that wouldn't love to go skydiving naked at the Super Bowl. Every one of you love it. But let me tell you, all the guys, see, but those of us who are humble would wear a mask. Right? Right. Yeah. But every one of the guys would float down through there saying, I bet they recognize me, you know? Yeah. Sure you relate to it. Every one of you do. You damn sure do, don't you? Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm not talking about that kind of ego. I'm talking about that kind of ego that says it's my way or the highway, you know? Well, the 10th step tells me what to do. It says each day we'll face self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What do? We ask God to remove it, talk to somebody, make our amends, help somebody. This program is incredibly simple, not easy, requires the destruction of self-centeredness. Wilson wrote it in his story. Incredibly simple. So I go into my office, drop on my knees, ask God to remove it, call my sponsor, talk to my sponsor, go out in the hall, call the girls back. They hadn't left yet. I fired them 6 months ago. They know I'm coming back. So I go out there and I call them back. They know I'm coming back. Old Goofy's done it again. So I call them back, hire them back. And then we talk about job descriptions and do things that grown-ups do that I have a real difficult time doing from time to time. Then I got to my men's meeting that night, which was... my home group at Trinity. Somebody said, anybody got any problem staying away from a drink or any problem they want to talk about their feelings or any living problem? I said, yeah, I'd like to bring something up. And said, what's that? And I said, how long have I got to deal with this insatiable ego? And it was kind of quiet for a minute. And then this guy raised his hand, who's about my age, been in the program about 2 years, and I've sponsored him the first year. And he raised his hand, looked at me, and he said, Burns, I don't know how long you're going to have to deal with that insatiable ego, but you taught me you just have to do it for today. You know, we raise them and they jump up and bite us right in the butt, right? Whop! Just like that. The joy of AA is tonight's guru may not be able to pick his nose tomorrow without threatening his brain, you know? You know, we just have to rotate gurus because they burn out from day to day. Those of us who try to become gurus, the group conscience just doesn't allow it. And tonight when we close, we'll close in a circle. There's only one pyramid, and we know what that pyramid's like in AA. But when we close at night, we close in a circle. And there will be a constant connection with nobody standing out front. Of course, experience, strength, and hope, and length of time in this program has multiple experiences that I can profit by, but we will close in a circle. And not one person, the one with 38 years of sobriety, is the same place in that circle as the one with 1 month of sobriety. And that's the strength of Alcoholics Anonymous. You ask me how I deal with that ego, I'm not going to leave you hanging. I do it very simply. I do it the way the big book writes it, because I found after multiple years and all kinds of training and all kinds of education and everything else, the simplicity of this program is exactly what works for me. The first thing is I get up in the morning and I get up on time. That eludes alcoholics for years, you know? This is real serious stuff right now, you know? My first 8 years, I'd talk to my sponsor and I'd say, Jim, what do you think are the psychological implications of my always being late in the morning? He'd say, "Why don't you get your ass up on time?" You know? So I get up on time. The second thing I do is I begin my morning with the 11-step prayer, just the way it's written in the big book. I do the 3rd-step prayer, and I do the 7th-step prayer. There are multiple sections in the big book on tolerance and patience. And it's absolutely critical for me to look at those issues about tolerance and patience. I am not tolerant of me, and I am not tolerant of you. I demand perfection of myself, and I demand for you to be just like me. And only in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous have I found the relief of not that kind of demanding. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, what I thought I had found was a program that would make me perfect. What I found was a program that would help me deal with the fact that I will always be imperfect. And what a relief. Also in the morning, I asked for God not to let me hurt anybody that day and not to let me hurt anybody else. That's very critical for me. That is very critical for me. Alcoholics Anonymous, or alcohol, has been called a disease of perception. I still call it peculiar mental twist. My recovery was a difference in perception. And I'm going to tell you a joke about perception. I've told this joke for 10 years, and I tell this joke because it's a wonderful joke. It's funny, and I tell it exceptionally well, and I really want to tell this joke. And I really do like this wonderful joke. Now, I don't know anything about flying airplanes, so give me a little poetic license. For those of you who've ever heard me talk before, you know what joke I'm going to tell, but I love this joke. There was this airline pilot, and he was sitting up there at 20,000 feet. The ceiling was 100 feet off the ground. Tire says you got one chance to put that plane on the ground after you come through that ceiling. Now you don't have to land it. You can go to a different airport, but if you try to put it on this runway, you got one chance to do it. He said, "I can do it." He said, "All right." So he brings it down through that 100-foot ceiling, puts it on that runway. The tires squeal. The smoke comes up off the tires. The nose of the plane comes right up over the edge of the runway, and it just shudders and shakes, and it settles down. The pilot's just sitting there sweating to beat heck, and he turns around to the co-pilot and he said, "I believe that's the shortest runway I've ever seen." Co-pilot's sitting there and he's just sweating to beat heck, and he turns, looks at the pilot, and he says, "Yeah, but did you notice how wide it is?" Now, they had a common problem and a common solution, but a different perception. Well, my recovery was a different perception. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in a Mayfield City jail. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. She was what we know today as a true adult child. I don't intend to get into that issue with anybody, but Big Book tells me very simply that if you're raised around one of us or live with one of us, you get neurotic, is what the Big Book says, and I just again call it goofy. You just don't stay around us without getting messed up big time. You begin to accept over a gradual period of time, Jeanette, you talked about acceptable behavior, and it just changes and it becomes real crazy. And my mama was so full of love. She's one of the gentlest, kindest little people I've ever known in my life. But she was really messed up with alcoholism. She never took a drink. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield in the middle 30s. This 4 AA begun. My grandfather died about 6 months before AA started. And when an alcoholic got drunk in Mayfield, they put him in jail. And when they sobered up, they put him in shackles and put him on a chain gang. And they swept the Mayfield City streets. And my mama used to walk past her daddy in a chain gang at least once a month, sweeping the Mayfield City streets. When I was in treatment and I left about a month early and they told me I shouldn't leave, and I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because you haven't dealt with your anger." And I said, "You kissed my behind. Of course I've dealt with my anger, you know." Well, they brought me out there and they had this ring, and this guy said, "I don't have time to mess around with you." He said, "You're going home and I need you to look at this." And so they put me out in this ring and they had a whole circle of people around me, and this counselor had me right opposite him. It was down at Mar. It was over Georgia Mental Health. Had me right opposite. He said, "I'm going to ask you a series of questions. You answer them just as fast as you can. Don't worry about the answer. Just answer it." First question, he said, who do you hate most in your whole life? And I said, I hate my mother's guts. And what seemed like a lifetime was probably only 15, 20, or 30 seconds. Rapid-fire questions and answers. I ended up on the ground hugging his calves, screaming how much I loved my mother and how much I hated me. And he picked me up and kissed me on the cheek. I'll never forget. And he said, now go home. You know what the problem is. He said, tell me about your mother. And as I started talking to him and told him about Mama walking past her daddy in the sweeping the Mayfield City streets, as I told him about my mother getting molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home, he said, how do you think your mother felt? And it hit me just like a saber right through my guts. The pain and the shame that that little woman endured. And for the first time in my whole life, the change happened. Just like Alcoholics Anonymous leads us to change, I began to feel her pain and ask, what can I do for my mother? Not what can she do for me? For the first time in my life, I felt and wanted to hold her and help her. But the way my mother's alcoholism presented itself in our home was conditional love. When I was perfect, Mama would talk to me. When I wasn't perfect, Mama wouldn't. So I solved that problem real quick. I became perfect. And when I'm talking in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and generally, when I tell you for sure, when I'm talking in a room of doctors in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm talking to a whole room of perfect kids. You know? Perfect kids for one reason or another. And if you'd seen my list of accolades in high school and college, you'd thought one day this guy may be president of the United States, but he'll never be an alcoholic. Alcohol and drugs were no problem for me in high school. They were no problem for me in college. I started medical school my freshman year. Now, I don't know about y'all, but there's always been a motor running in me. Y'all ever felt that motor? Get to A, get to B, get to C, get to D. What'd you miss A? Go back and just like that. You know, always moving. You're never quite sure what it was you missed, but you know you missed something. You know? The big book calls it irritable, restless, and discontented. We professionals call it stimulus augmentation or hyper-augmentation. Think about it, sitting in an AA meeting, you're sitting in the middle of a whole bunch of hyperactive adults. You ever watched it? And now our medical studies show us that 75% of adult male alcoholics have attention deficit disorder. We're hyperactive adults. And I knew that. I've lived it. I've sitting there listening to y'all talk. I've watched it while I've been up here. About three quarters of you are hyperactive as heck. And I can sit around and watch it. And I'm happy with you because I'm just sitting here getting hyperactive with you, you know? And that's without coffee. I mean, that's just sitting there with nothing in me, not even any sugar. And the way it came out when I walked into medical school, the dean walked out and he said, there are 100 of you in this class. Only 75 of you will graduate. I don't care if there are 100 A's, the last 25 A's are flunked. Look at the guy next to you because he isn't going to be here next year. He may not be. And I turned to look at that sucker and he's looking right back at me. And I thought, oh, God, it's me. I'm not going to make it. So I just went to pieces. I couldn't study. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do anything. And after 2 weeks of doing that, I just packed up my clothes and started home. As I walked out the door, a good friend of mine, he still is, walked up to me and handed me this little capsule called amphetamine. He said, take this. It'll help you to study. I took that amphetamine, and the motor stopped. I could study. I could sleep. I could go to bed and sleep. I found four things that'll stop my motor, and it'll stop it every time. Amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and Alcoholics Anonymous. AA works best. It just takes a little longer, okay? It just takes a little longer. And they haven't put me in jail one time for going to AA meetings. And I got in jail for every one of those others. Absolutely. First semester of my freshman year, I was number one in my class. Second semester, I was number 100. Amphetamine owned me immediately. 2 weeks before graduation, I was kicked out of medical school for beating up one of my medicine professors in an amphetamine rage. They took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Keller looked at me and he said, Burns, what's wrong with you? And I said, I take too many drugs. And he said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, we can help you. I said, what are you going to do? And he said, we're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. We're going to help you figure out why you take that drug. If you can figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. If you figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. What they were saying is you're going to think yourself into a way of acting. Their perception was you're going to think yourself into a way of acting. Works beautifully in daily living. It's called cognitive cause and effect thinking. It works beautifully. We solve our problems. We live our lives by it. It doesn't work worth a hoot in alcoholism and drug addiction. It just doesn't work. There are a lot of reasons why it doesn't, but it just doesn't work. Mostly because we really do have sawdust for brains for about 6 months to 2 years, and ain't no way to speed that up. It's just going to be that way. We have to do the things we have to do. Now, I'm not anti-psychiatry. Neither is the big book in the program by Alcoholics Anonymous. Carl Jung actually technically could be considered the father of our program. Carl Jung gave Roland Hazard the message, and it's in the big book. Roland came home and gave it to Abby Thatcher. Abby Thatcher went to Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson went to Bob Smith, and that's why we're here tonight, and it's why it works so well. Because Carl Jung told Roland Hazard, you're going to have a major spiritual experience, a psychic displacement. The very thing that turned my life around. Was an absolute confidant of Bill Wilson, a very knowledgeable psychiatrist, had a great deal to do with forming Bill Wilson's thinking. No, I'm not anti-psychiatry. Psychiatry actually helped me. They taught me how to identify a feeling. Didn't keep me from taking drugs, but they taught me how to identify a feeling. When I came to y'all 15 years later, you put that into a process that ended up with a spiritual solution, and that's what brought relief. That's what brought relief. I tell you what, I'm not anti-psychiatry, but I'm dead set against ignorance. My God has led me, and this is not an arrogant statement because my sponsor and my close-knit support group has supported me in making these moves, but I left practice 2 years ago to become chairman of the impaired physicians for the state of Kentucky. In that position, I'm able to change or have a great deal to do with changing the curriculum at both medical schools, to tour the entire 7,000 doctors in our state teaching. In the last 6 months, I've been in for 4,000 of those 7,000 doctors teaching them how to treat alcoholism. I've been given more opportunities, and God trained me for those years to be ready for this. Because He also trained me in a spiritual solution which says, that's your charge, that's your challenge. You are a physician. He also told me to carry this message to Alcoholics Anonymous because I eat, live, and sleep with you people. I educate and train and work professionally with the other group. The message to Alcoholics Anonymous is one we must hear. We must hear it. There are a number of people in Alcoholics Anonymous practicing medicine without a license, and it's got to stop. It's got to stop. The tragedies have been almost incredible, and I have been just as guilty as anybody else out of ignorance and fear. Big Book says that if we be honest with our doctors, they'll treat us right. Well, I tell you, that ain't true. Because now there are a whole bunch more doctors, and some of us just didn't know the difference. And hopefully we can educate them so when you tell them the truth, they will treat you right. But don't fall into that prey that all doctors are bad and that all of them are stupid, because they're just not. And those of us who have stayed in this profession and stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous can help you a great deal to know the ones to go to, and we're more than willing to do it. Psychiatry did help me, didn't keep me from taking drugs. I got back into medical school after 2 years. They asked me how I was feeling. I said, I'm afraid. I did not take any drugs during that time. They said, why are you afraid? And I said, I'm afraid because I whipped one of them. They're going to be watching me. And they said, well, should they be watching? And I said, yes, they should be watching me, and I should be afraid. And they said, good, now you can own the feeling. The feeling won't have to own you. And I said, that makes all kinds of sense. And I walked back into medical school prepared to be able to be just fine, and within 30 minutes I strung out on amphetamine again. And I just sat there and cried because I didn't know what the deal was. My classmates enabled me. They take me home, put me to bed. I was married and had one small child. My wife would call the medical school, tell them I had the flu. They knew better, but they didn't know what to do with me. They'd given it their best shot. They told me then, and they've told me today. Some of those people are still alive, and they said, Burns, you were a good man and a good doctor, and we knew someday we just hoped maybe you'd quit that. So I graduated in 1964, and between 64 and 67, I was in the mental hospital in Louisville, strapped down, IV fluid, straitjackets four times. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, but I always got back on it. It always owned me. Went in the Army in 67, got back on amphetamine. The post commander came down and said, Burns, are you taking amphetamine? And I said, yes, sir. He said, if you don't quit, we'll put you in Leavenworth. So I quit. You know, once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. Well, the deal was that I still could quit. That day was going to be over. In 1969, I came home, got back on amphetamine, had a gallbladder attack, and two members of the board of licensure and my surgeon and an internist in Louisville came down, sat beside my bed, said, "Burns, please quit taking the amphetamine." They actually prayed with me, and I'll never forget it. They actually prayed with me, and I quit taking amphetamine. Then I started drinking. First 4 years was not alcoholic. I might get drunk, I might stay sober, but I didn't set out to get drunk, I didn't set out to stay sober. It was not an obsession. The next 3 years was alcoholic. I didn't get drunk as often those 3 years. I really didn't. But if you didn't drink, we didn't run together. If restaurants didn't serve alcohol, I didn't go. I knew exactly how much I could drink and make it through a football game, exactly how much I could drink and get home. I knew exactly when I could drink, exactly what I could drink, and exactly what it would do. Then it turned on me. The last year of my drinking, I drank addictively. I drank a quart of whiskey a night. And told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. And I could believe it. What I had to admit when I finally did get sober was my office hours the last 3 months of my practice consisted of about 30 minutes a day. You know, 15 minutes to get there, 10 minutes to look at the mail, and 5 minutes to try to get home because I was withdrawing. Somewhere between Thanksgiving and December 1st of 1977, Casey and I were now living together. My divorce was a long and drawn out type of thing. We met each other, she explained to you, then we got together and started living together, and I realized I had something very special in my life, and I knew if I didn't quit drinking, I would run her off, and I did not want to run her off. She meant everything in the world to me. I couldn't stand the lying, I couldn't stand the cheating, I couldn't stand the drinking, I couldn't stand all the people I was hurting, but as much as anything else, I did not want to lose her. And I got to say something that we talk a lot of time about motive and getting into recovery. I will tell you what my 16 years of experience has taught me. I don't care what your motive is coming into us. You come on in. You come on in. You take our hand, and one day your motive will be to be just like us. Because we're winners. You will learn to want to be sober for you. But I don't care what your motive is coming in. Just come on in. Come home. Come on home. You're tired and it's over. You're tired and it's over. I did not want to run her off, and so I decided I'd change my drink. My drink was choice was scotch and water, so I quit drinking that, and I tried to drink martinis, and I drank 24 martinis one night and couldn't get drunk. I drank a bottle of beer the next day and couldn't walk for 3 days. But that's alcoholism. That morning, she'd gone to work, and I got up and I watched the sun. And I said, "God, I can't drink whiskey and I can't take amphetamine. I know what I'll do. I'll smoke dope." And I thought, "Who are you kidding, man? This stuff doesn't work in you. I don't know why it doesn't work in you." And I thought, "Well, then I just won't do anything." And I thought, "You can't live in this world without doing something. For 22 years, you never have. You can't do it." And that's when I couldn't live with it and I couldn't live without it. Completely hopeless and completely helpless. I said, "God, please help me." And I do not know that God did this. I truly don't. I know what I feel, but I can't tell you. But it dawned on me what I had to do, and the peace was just incredible. I mean, the peace was incredible. I walked back to my bedroom, loaded my shotgun, and put it in my mouth. I did not mind dying. Dying would stop it. It'd be over. I was scared to death of living. Didn't know how. People have asked me over the years why I did not pull the trigger. And it took me until about 2 years ago to know why I didn't pull the trigger. It was the absence of dignity. Those years that Mama loved me and Daddy loved me and the church gave me messages, they brought me dignity. And I didn't pull that trigger because of the absence of dignity. I will tell you one word that's synonymous with recovery for me. It's the return of dignity. Every one of us in this room has lost it. Some of you don't have it back yet, but for those of us who have done the work, stayed in rank long enough, we have known the return of dignity. And for those people who never lost it, they can't relate to us. But for those of us who lost it, we know what it hurt, how it hurts. And for those of us who have found it, it is the peace that passes understanding, the return of dignity. I asked for help. They sent me to a psych hospital in New York for 2 weeks, transferred me to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta for 28 days, moved in a halfway house system where I stayed 2 months, then I came home to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to you people, I said, what have I got to do not to get drunk and be happy? And you said, you do anything we tell you to do. You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. You hear it? 180 degrees difference. The mental health field said you're going to think yourself into a way of acting. Alcoholics Anonymous says you're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. The profundity of Alcoholics Anonymous fascinates me. There used to be an old guy in Louisville named Charlie R. Remember Charlie? Maybe the most spiritual person I ever knew. Charlie always talked like he had a mouth full of mush and a head full of Valium, but he's probably the most spiritual person I ever knew. He'd come up to me, he'd appear almost out of the night. He looked a lot like you, George. I swear to God, when I saw you, you reminded me of Charlie. Even talk like him. No, you don't talk like Charlie. Charlie talked worse than you. But Charlie would come up to me, he'd just appear out of the night sometimes almost, and he'd say, Barnes, you think this program's fascinating? I'd say, yeah, Charlie, I really think. And he said, that's good, because people who quit thinking it's fascinating seem to get drunk a lot. And then he'd just turn around and walk off. And I'd say, who was that masked man, you know? But Alcoholics Anonymous fascinates me, continues to fascinate me, because the truths are there and they're so simple. I said, okay, what have I got to do? You told me to do anything that you tell me to do. What have I got to do? And you said, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. Never changes. They keep it simple for people like me that can screw up a plate of spaghetti, right? I said, okay, don't drink. They just beat it to death. Don't drink. Don't drink. All they do is talk about it. Don't drink. Don't drink. Why do they say that? I know don't do that. Why do they think it's so important? Stuck this tape of Sandy Beaches in there, and he said, every time he got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. And I thought, the man's a genius. He's figured out this whole deal, you know? So I said, I thought the reason I got drunk was my ex-wife and the medical community not appreciating me, and the fact that I was born poor and had to caddy at the country club rather than belong. I had all the litany of excuses. No, he said, every time you got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. So if you don't want to get drunk, don't drink. I thought, that makes sense. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Now, go to meetings. I'm going to take you over 14 years of meetings. I'm sorry, 16 years of meetings. Go back with me to that little home in Mayfield. I came in one night my junior year. In high school, I'd had one bottle of beer. I walked in, and I sat down and threw up. I normally didn't drink. Daddy walked in, looked at me, he said, Burns Mac, you've been drinking? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, are you drunk? And I said, no, sir. And he talked to me. He said, you're really not, are you? And I said, no. He said, well, here, let me help you clean this up. And you go on up to bed, and we'll talk about it in the morning. To go from the living room upstairs to mine, my brother's bedroom, you had to go up these stairs, and Mom and Daddy's bedroom was sitting right here, right where you go up the stairs. Now, remember that little lady had been ripped with alcoholism. She had two boys. I was the doctor designate, and my brother, who was 8 years younger, was the lawyer designate. They were her pathway to credibility. She lived in that shame, which she never had the chance to deal with. We were her pathway to credibility. And here was the number one son, the doctor designate, with alcohol on his breath. And I turned to go up those stairs, and here came my mother coming out of that bedroom, and she was roaring. She wasn't but about 4'10", but she was a dynamo. She came out of there like a tornado, grabbed me by the hair of the head, and went, whop, 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 you little bastard, I'll never talk to you again. And it took me about 8 years of psychiatric therapy and 4, 5, 4th, or 5th steps to ever really feel, to be able to acknowledge what I felt. And you know what I felt? I felt, and you bitch, I'll never trust you again. You bitch, I'll never trust you again. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't trust a one of you. I didn't trust a one of you. I'd had 8 years of psychiatric therapy, deacon in 5 churches. Now, psychiatry helped me, the church helped me, but it didn't keep me sober. And when I came to you people, you were my last resort. If you didn't work, it was over. And I didn't trust a one of you. And let me tell you, what I found out is Alcoholics Anonymous is a perfect program composed of a lot of very imperfect people, and some of us you can't trust. My first 5th step should have been on the front page of the local newspaper the next day. When we came in this program, you've seen my wife. She's a cute, handsome, beautiful little lady. And there were people in Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to take her to bed all the time. I understood that. I didn't appreciate it, but I understood it. There were people wanting to take me to bed, and that confused me a lot. I mean, I had little spindly legs, little spindly arms. I had little spiders all over my face. I didn't even want to take me to bed, and here were these people wanting to take me to bed. There were people who wanted to borrow money and didn't intend to pay it back, and they didn't. And man, I was confused. I didn't understand this. I thought all you people were really going to be honest, and I'd just come to the place where everything was perfect. You know? Finally, I began to ask those people who wanted to take me out to coffee. I'd say, "Why do you want to take me out to have coffee?" And the winners would say, "Because we want to stay sober and we want to help you stay sober." And I began to find the winners. I began to find out the ones who wore the white hats and those who wore the black hats. And this was absolutely critical for me, because I was so fragile and so vulnerable, and I had to find the winners. If you haven't found the winners, then you keep looking. I've got people who come to me and say, "Burns, I'm never going back to that Tuesday night meeting. That SOB said blah, 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 blah." I said, "Come on, he probably didn't say that. Let's just go down there and see." And I'll go down there and sit there for about 5 minutes. I'll say, "By God, he really did say that. That guy's an idiot, you know." And I'll take this guy and I say, "Well, let's go to some more meetings." So we just go to more meetings. If you want what we have, and whiskey whipped you as bad as it whipped me, then stick around. You'll find the winners and you'll find the meetings. They're here. God has prepared this place for us, and they're here. Find us and go with us. The second thing I found out about meeting, I learned to trust. For the first time in my life, trust came into my life. And it had to come in. It had to come in, because I had to be told what to do. Maybe some of you don't have to be, but I had to be. I was that sick and that crazy. Second thing I found out about meetings is them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. Jim W. from down Dallas one time said, when he came in the program, said he'd hide from his sponsor, and his sponsor would come find him and take him to meetings. Said he'd hide and he'd find him, take him to meetings. He'd hide and he'd find him, take him to meetings. Said one night I hid so well he couldn't find me. So next day he called me and said, "Well, Jim, you missed it last night." He said, "What did I miss?" He said, "You didn't hear what you were supposed to hear." And he said, "Well, what was it?" And he said, "I don't know. I heard what I was supposed to hear, but you'll never know what you were supposed to hear." I've never walked out of a meeting that I didn't hear what I was supposed to hear. Most of the time today I walk out and I feel real good. I feel up. I feel better. There's some meetings I walk out of and you could string my thoughts out on a line and you could put beads on them. I'm so mad when I walk out of that meeting and I say, "Okay, God, what's the message?" And I feel this voice say, "The message is in the 5th chapter of the 4th step. It's called a resentment, sucker, and you might get drunk over it. Go home and read it." So I always hear what I'm supposed to hear. When I became a student of this big book and really did know what Wilson and God through Wilson, as I choose to believe it, was saying to us, I found in the second chapter, there is a solution. And I'm going to paraphrase this. He said, "There will come a day when we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation, basically, of our last drink." We literally forget what happened to us. When I'm walking around or driving around showing doctors all these formulas, when I get through, they say, "You mean that's alcoholism?" I say, "That's alcoholism." They say, "Why do y'all ever drink again?" I said, "Because we forgot what happened to us last time we got drunk." I sit in AA meetings and you ask somebody why they had a slip, and what they tell you each time is they forgot what happened. We have a way of saying the further you are from your last drink, the closer you are to your next one. Isn't it beautiful that God gave us a mind with selective memory so that the pain doesn't stay there and rip us apart forever? But isn't it even more beautiful, at least it is to me, that He gave us a program that gently reminds us on a daily basis of what we are, lest we forget? When I walk in the meeting, I'm reminded of what I am through the grace of God, this program by Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, the 12 steps in the big book. I can tell you that you have helped me define for me who I am. If I forget what I am, I will lose who I am. I am Burns Brady. I am an alcoholic. It's that simple. I go to a lot of meetings today because that's where my friends are. And finally, I go to a lot of meetings today because I don't want to miss the miracle. I used to lay on the floor drinking Scotch whiskey and listening to Neil Diamond's "I Am." I cried and I'd say, "God, show me a miracle. Please show me a miracle. Give me a burning bush, just one burning bush." You know where He sent me? He sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. How many burning bushes are in this room? Every one of us. Every one of us. Burning bushes. Don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. I said, okay, I'd get the big book down, I'd read that sucker, and I think that's beautiful, and close it, couldn't remember it. I'd open it again, I'd read it, and I think that's beautiful, and close it, couldn't remember. Get my meditation book and read it, and close. I'd come into the AA meeting, I'd say, I can't remember anything. And you'd say, oh, don't worry about it, none of us can. I said, well, how long does that last? About 6 months, 2 years. You get better, oh yeah, it always gets better. And I'd come in the next night and I'd say, I can't remember anything because I forgot what you told me the night before, you know. I used to lose my car drinking all the time. I lost my car the first 6 months to a year sober. I'd drive my car to work and go in, practice medicine, come out, get in my car and drive it off. Drive to work, practice medicine, get in, drive it off. One day I drove Casey's car, parked it, went in, practice medicine, came out, looked around. I said, oh my God, somebody stole my car. Went in, got my partner, and I said, day somebody stole my car. And he came out and he said, Burns, you drove Casey's car. And I said, oh, that's right, I forgot. So they assigned me a parking space. Oh yeah. And they said, when Burns leaves work, he's going to that parking space. If he get whatever's in it started, he's gonna drive it home. Yeah. Medical science studied us in 1975. I mean, they published, we'd known it since 1936. But medical science studied us in 1975 and published, said the alcoholic will lose the power of retentive memory for recent events for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving and stress management will be screwed up 6 months to 2 years. Sleep patterns will be screwed up. I used to come in meetings and I'd say, I can't sleep. And somebody said, oh, nobody ever died from lack of sleep. And I'd go, oh God, they don't know how I'm hurting, you know. But that's the way it is. I gave this talk in Bull Shoals, Arkansas, and there's a guy sitting back there about where you're sitting. And he was sitting down in his chair, and he had his hat pulled down over his eyes, and he was slouched down. You didn't know when you got through if he's going to kiss you or stab you. It was in his great big tent. And when I said, just stick with us. If you think your mind's, you've burned up your mind, I promise you haven't. It'll be okay. Just stick with us. One day it'll clear up. He came out of that seat and said, hallelujah, thank God. I thought I'd lost my mind. And I mean, everywhere I went that weekend, he came around behind me. He said, Dr. Brady belched. Doctor, no matter what I did, he thought I had the truth. You know, I said, God, I know why you sent me to this meeting. That sucker got it. So I thought, don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. If I can't read the big book, can't remember it, oh God, it won't work for me. I swear it's not going to work. How does it work? And I remember we read how it works, so I was getting better. So I flipped open the book and said, how it works. And there in that first paragraph there it was, honesty, 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 three times. There are those of us who may be constitutionally incapable of being honest. There are those of us who have grave emotional and mental disorders, but if we have the capacity to be honest, we can make it. Those who do not make it are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with ourselves. I worked with people come and say, I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And I said, no, Bill Wilson was talking about a small group of people called sociopaths. They can't be honest because they don't know the difference in right and wrong. I said, I've seen 4 sociopaths in this program in 15 years, but I've seen a lot of liars. You know? Yeah. When I went to treatment, I begged to go to treatment drinking a quart of whiskey a night, and I sat there in front of the guy running the treatment center, and he said, Burns, how much do you drink? And I said, I drank a 6-pack of beer every night. He says, you're lying. I said, I know what I do it all the time. Why'd I do that? I'd play golf, and I'd hit my ball. The summer before I went to treatment, I'd hit my ball on the green, go up there and put a dime in front of the ball, and come back and put that ball in front of that dime. Saved myself a fourth of an inch on a 40-foot putt, and I just hated my guts. Time after time, I'd do it. I came back that first summer after treatment. I'd hit that ball on the green. I'd go up there, and I'd put that dime behind that ball, and I'd put that ball back in front of that dime, and I'd walk off that green feeling good about me. Didn't have a clue as what was happening, but I felt good about me. Somebody said, you ask Burns Brady anything, he'll tell you the truth. It may not have a thing to do with what you're talking about, but he'll tell you the truth. I listened in meetings today and people said, this is cash register honesty. You bet your life is cash register honesty. And it's as important to me today as it was 16 years ago when I walked in this program. I can tell you half the truth or I can tell you half truths. But when I know it, it guts me. I was taught early on, we're only as sick as our secrets. The big book says we got to be honest with somebody. It tells me that I cannot live in a myth of truth. It has to be the truth. And cash register honesty means everything to me. The closest I've come to getting drunk in this program is when I compromised my honesty and knew it. People said, well, you got to be honest with yourself. I believe that. There's a problem with that. It's in the 10 steps that alcohol is subtle. Alcohol is subtle, the peculiar mental twist. Clancy says 20,000 feet, 20 years of sobriety. He and God are driving along. He looks down and says, God, there's AA. How are they doing? And God says, Clancy, they're doing fine. He said, God, how am I doing? He said, Clancy, you're doing great. I bet you could have a light beer. 2 years in the program, a young lady came up to me and she said, I want to have my birthday at St. Thomas on Westport Road. And I said, that's a discussion meeting. She said, it's my birthday and I can do anything I want to do. And I said, I need to go home and pray about it because that's my home group and that's a discussion meeting. And we've never had a speaker meeting, but I'm going to go home and pray about it. And I got home and I got on my knees and I said, God, and I was dead serious. I said, God, please help me. Should we make this a discussion or a speaker meeting and have her birthday at that speaker meeting? God, tell me what to do. And I felt this voice say, Burns, it should be a speaker meeting and you should be the speaker. And I called the guru of that meeting. You know, every meeting has a guru. They sit at the front door and take everybody's inventory when they walk in, you know. We have to rotate them because they get burned out periodically. But everybody has a guru. So I called the guru of this meeting. I said, Jim, next Tuesday night we're going to have a speaker meeting over St. Thomas. And I'm going to be speaker for Patty's birthday. And he said, how'd you figure that out? I said, I prayed to God and God said it'd be okay. And he said, I'll get back to you in about 10 minutes. He's at the Token Club. So he got Fritz, some people that Roe and the Wessels know. So he gets Fritz and Jim Russell and a bunch of those and Jim Parrott, and they all get back there. In the back room, he calls me and he said, Burns, he said, I don't understand this. Strangest thing. I said, what's that? And he said, you know, he told me who was there. And they're my friends. They are today. He said, we got back in the back room and we prayed about it. And I don't understand this. But said, right now it's 5-1, the God of our understanding over the God of your understanding. It's imperative for me to deal with the subtlety of alcoholism. I've known the inspiration of prayer, and I have known the complete destruction of isolated prayer. Prayer and share. Prayer and share. Share the prayer. This is my story, and it takes every bit of that for me not to succumb to the subtlety of alcoholism. I must maintain the spiritual condition. It takes a home group, a sponsor, meetings, the big book, the 12 steps, trust God, clean house, help others, every bit of it. Every bit of it. First year of my recovery was absolute insanity. During that period of time, I'd call my sponsor 6 and 7 times a day, sometimes 6 and 7 times a day. I would practice medicine, walk out, and I'd be doing fine practicing medicine, but I did not know how to live. I was absolutely flying apart almost every minute. After about a year and a half, it began to clear up. Then after about 2 years, it cleared up, and I became little Mr. AA. Get up on time, eat your breakfast, say your prayers, call your sponsor, get to the office, see your patients, be on time, call your sponsor, call your wife, eat your lunch, call your sponsor, call your wife, get home in the evening, eat your supper, get to the meetings 30 minutes early, set up the ashtrays, set up the coffee, greet the newcomer, give him your telephone number, get his telephone number, stay 30 minutes late, talk in the meeting, share sometime, listen to somebody, learn to talk, learn to share, learn to listen, get home in the evening, ask your sponsor to tell him good night, kiss your wife, go to sleep, boom, 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 little Mr. Perfect AA. Any of y'all relate to that? This is wonderful because it says as alcoholics we are undisciplined. We allow God to discipline us in this way. And after 5 years in the program, I was little Mr. Perfect AA. And I was walking around like this, just rigid as hell. And the old timers would come up to me and say, Burns, how are you doing? I said, I'm fine. This is a smile, you idiot. This is a smile. And the old timers like Bob would look at me and they'd say, yeah. I was down in South Georgia visiting my first spiritual director. He was my next door neighbor, Episcopal priest, and somebody I loved dearly. And he moved to South Georgia, Thomasville. And Casey and I were down there visiting Jim and Pamela. And I talked to Jim, and I came back to the Holiday Inn, and I was just like this, and I dropped on my knees, and I said, God, please help me. Casey put her hands on my shoulder and said, call your sponsor. My first sponsor had a two-step program, and I tell you that as a report. That's a report. That is not a judgment. But I tell you that because I want you to hear what he told me. There are no coincidences. I called Jim and I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. He said, Burns, you're the most compliant person I've ever known. Do you believe you'll get this program? I said, I don't know. He said, when you get home, we'll talk about it. As I started to hang up the phone, he said, let me ask you something. I said, yeah. He said, do you believe if you work these steps perfectly, it'll make you good? I said, yeah. He said, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, do you believe if you get drunk today, it'll make you bad? I said, yeah. And he said, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it. You can't kick it away. God loves you just the way you are. I tried to be perfect for Mama and she couldn't handle it. I tried to be perfect for me and I couldn't do it. I tried to be perfect for God and he didn't need it. The story of the prodigal son became an absolute reality for me. Yes, it's the story of the drunk who comes home. And yes, it's the story of the brother who has resentments. But for me, it came to mean it was the story of the father who waits. And I have found through 16 years, if I am willing and put my hand in his, it always works. The only block to my being with my father is me. It is me. The next 3 years, God was preparing me to be able to love unconditionally as he loved me. I did not know that. All my life, I've taken hostages. My biggest hostage in AA, no, my second biggest hostage was my sponsor. I picked a sponsor who liked to tell people what to do, and I desperately wanted somebody to tell me what to do. I didn't want to take responsibility. He made every decision for me. 8.5 years in the program, I had a sponsor who made every decision for me. Every one of them. I was 50 years old, a physician, 8.5 years sober, and never made a decision. He made every one for me. Then I would go to my pigeons, and I would tell them what he told me. He became so goofy at that time, literally, that his behavior became so erratic that I could not stay. People come in and say, Burns, why don't you get away from him? I said, he gave me so much, and boy, did he ever. He's one of God's greatest gifts to me. I am so grateful for that man in my life and will always be grateful for that man in my life. And that's the truth. But I had to move away. I had to change all of my meetings and get a new sponsor. And I was scared to death. My biggest hostage was my wife. Oh boy, did I love her, and I really did. I put her right there on my hip, and I took her everywhere. I took her everywhere. You know, I'd call her at 10 in the morning and say, Casey, I love you. I would call her at 3 in the afternoon and say, Casey, I love you. I'd call her at 10 in the morning sometimes, and she wouldn't be there. Then I'd call at 3 in the afternoon and say, Casey, I love you. Where were you at 10 this morning? I got her a telephone and put it in her car because I was worried to death that she might break down on the road like some of y'all have a tendency to do, I've been told, but that she might break down on the road. And I had a telephone put in her car. And interestingly enough, she'd get 10 or 11 calls a day, and guess who they were from? Me. Me. Because I wanted to know that she was okay. She came to me about that time and she said, Burns, I've never loved you more, but I want to go to school. I want to go into therapy, and I want to go to my own AA meetings. And I said, honey, that's fine. What I felt was, and I'll not trust you, you bitch. I went to my new sponsor, and I said, I'm going to get me another woman. I don't have to put up with that. He said, you can get another woman if you want to, but if you don't change your attitudes, you'll run her off just like you're running this one off. And I just sat there and cried because I didn't know what he meant. When the student's ready, the teacher will always arrive. In this case, this little pigeon of mine with 7 months of sobriety walked up to me and gave me 8 tapes. And he said, would you listen to these tapes and see if they're any good? They were Joe and Charlie's tapes, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, I knew the program that I didn't have. Had 12 copies made and 12 of us started a Big Book study 7 years ago. We've been through divorces. We've been through infidelity. We've been through slips. And finally, now one of us is getting ready to die. John has metastatic lung cancer. 4 years ago, John started playing golf with us. 2 years ago, he quit. A year ago, he was told he was going to die. We met on the back porch of one of the guys, and we said, John, we held hands together, sitting in a circle. We talked about death. We talked about John's dying. We talked about the things that people talk about when they love each other. Finally, we said, John, what can we do for you? And he said, I started playing golf with you guys because I really wanted to be with you, but I hated that game. He said, and I had to quit because I hated it so bad. He said, but would y'all play golf with me this summer? So we take John out and put him on the cart. He's a lousy golfer. He's a rotten golfer, but he had more fun, and we had more fun with him. That has sprung into multiple big book studies. And what I found in studying that book is the real reason why I'm on the face of God's earth. I've always wondered why, and it's stated in many places and very simplistically. I'm here to fit myself to be of maximum service to you and to my God. It's that simple. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. I took it into our home, and I supported Casey in going to school. I became more of a part of the solution rather than the problem. What Casey didn't tell you is she graduated number one in her class. And what she wanted for graduation was a little red truck, and we went out and got her that little red truck, and it says, "My truck." There is a thin line between codependency and spirituality. I have known both. With codependency, there are always strings. I will give you everything I've got, and what I ask in return is you give everything you've got. With spirituality, I will give you anything I've got, and you don't have to give it back. Someone once said, "What do you do with unacceptable behavior?" If you read the promise, that for me is the biggest promise in our whole book, it's right before the promises, and it says, "If we're sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody." What an incredible serenity to be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble, and be able to say to someone, "I cannot help you. I cannot be around you. I love you," and walk off, rather than my old way, which was to say, "I hate your guts, I'll slap your face, and don't ever get in touch with me again." Big difference. I'll close by telling you a couple of stories, and I appreciate your patience. First story has to do with my daughter. 17 years ago, my daughter sat straddling my face. I was passed out drunk, and she was strung out on amphetamine, Darvon, Valium, and alcohol. She tried to kill me, and the only reason she didn't is because she was using an automatic shotgun, didn't know how to load it. She got in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous 12 years ago. 5 years ago, she got married, and guess who she asked to give her away? Daddy. 2 years ago, on June the 22nd, it was my 55th birthday, and I was at an AA conference, and Casey and I came home Sunday night. It was Father's Day, in addition to my birthday, and when we drove up in the driveway, there were balloons above the mailbox, balloons above the garage, and balloons above the front door. And when I turned the balloon around, it says, "To the world's greatest dad on his birthday, with all of my love, Sissy." My son came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous 9 years ago. He flunked out of high school his senior year. He was living with his mother. He lived with us from age 11 to age 14, and he told us just recently that he started drinking, and he knew I'd catch him, so he just went back to his mother. His drinking really flourished with living with his mother, and she didn't talk to me. She didn't like me, so she wouldn't tell me anything about it. Of course, he wasn't. Stole all of her jewelry one piece at a time. He's allowed me to tell this. She either ignored it or didn't know it. Stole all of her silverware one piece at a time, and she either didn't know it or ignored it. What she couldn't ignore is when he stole her car. So she let him go. She called the police on him. They put him in jail. Now, for a year prior to this, I'd begun to suspect what was happening. And Casey and I had worked very hard on being spiritually prepared to do what we had to do for that boy. And I worked exceptionally hard to be able to do what I had to do for that boy. Now, please understand, I do not think anybody should precipitously do this. A year in preparation to be able to do it. To do what was best for him. His mother kicked him out of the house, and he came and said, "Daddy, I'd like to live with you." And I said, "Son, if you go off to treatment, we'll talk about it." He said, "Treatment for what?" And I said, "Treatment for your alcoholism." He said, "I'm not an alcoholic." I said, "If you want to live on the streets, then that's your call. If you want to live with me, you're an alcoholic, and you need treatment." He said, "Screw you." turned around, walked out of the house. And as he walked out, I just dropped on my knees and started crying. I said, God, please, please help me know what to do. I had my sponsor, support group. I had it all there, multiple prayers to be able to know what to do for that boy. For 4 months, I knew where he was every night, every day, and I knew God would help me do what I had to do. After 4 months, he came back and said, Daddy, get me help. Sent him off to treatment. He came back home from treatment. About a year later, we were in a meeting together, and a woman raised her hand and said, my boy went off to camp with two boys. They're smoking dope. I know my son is too. What can I do for him? A bunch of us talked. Finally, my boy raised his hand and said, I don't know what you can do to help him. I said, I'll tell you what turned my life around. I said, my sister was somebody I really loved. I said, she started doing dope, started drinking whiskey, and said she became somebody I didn't really like, but I loved her. I said, then she got in Alcoholics Anonymous, became a lady. He said, well, what turned my life around was my daddy. Said he used to come home and slap mother when he was drunk. He used to come up and whip us. Said then he left home and he'd tell us he'd come back and get us, and he never showed up. Said, but he got into Alcoholics Anonymous and he came, told mother he was sorry, paid her some money that he owed her, always was there to pick me and Sissy up when he told us he'd be there. And said, when I was out there on those streets, I knew I wanted to grow up to be just like my daddy. Be careful how you walk and talk. You may be the only big book somebody will ever read. My son went to commercial arts school, and he started a little business about 2 years ago. And about a year ago, we were together talking about when I started my business. And we got through talking. I said, son, I really love you. And he said, I love you too, Daddy. As I walked out to go across to get in my car, he said, hey, Dad. And I said, what? He said, don't drink. Go to meetings and read the big book. Finally, it's my daddy. My mother died in 1978. I was a year sober, and I got a chance to hug her and love her. Mother and I never really had a problem. I made my amends, and she listened. She said, I love you, son. The only time it ever bothered me is when you never called me, and I didn't know what was wrong. Said, there was a year one time you never told me where you were, and said, I was just so frightened that something would happen to you. Mama and I didn't have a problem. When Mama died, Daddy, over the next couple of years, got remarried to a beautiful lady, my stepmother. And then about 4 years ago, my daddy started to lose his mind. First of all, he forgot who I was, and he forgot who my brother was, and then he forgot mother ever was alive. About 2 years ago, he was put in a nursing home, and I would drive down each weekend to see Daddy. As I'd drive down, I'd park in the parking lot of the nursing home, and I'd say, God, please take away this pain. Please take away my pain. I'd walk in, and I'd do whatever I did with Daddy, and then I'd leave, and God would cry, and it just took away. There was just so much pain. It just churned and churned. This one Sunday, I drove in there and parked the car, and I said, dear God, let me be for my daddy today what you want me to be. Let me be for my daddy today what you want me to be. I walked into the nursing home, and Daddy, I didn't call him Daddy anymore because that confused him. He was sitting in a wheelchair, and he thought I was my Uncle Buster, his brother. I walked in, and I said, Hal, how you doing? He said, Buster, I'm doing fine. I said, can I help you? And he said, yeah, would you shave me? I said, sure. So I got a razor, and I shaved him. I said, Hal, would you like some lunch? And he said, sure would, Buster. So I rolled him in there. He's in a wheelchair. He couldn't walk. Rolled him in there, got his food, and fed him. He was too weak to feed himself. About that time, Peggy came in, my stepmother, and she and I sat there talking back and forth. Mom and I had done this for years. Daddy was always real quiet. He never would say a word. He was always there for me, but he never would say a word. I tried to make my amends to him. He said, Burns Mac, I can't talk about it. I wanted Daddy to talk to me so bad I could taste it. I've worked with hundreds of men in this program, and I've never seen one man that didn't want his daddy to say, it's okay. I don't care if that man's 80 years old, he'd give his eye teeth to have Daddy come back and say, it's okay. And I wanted Daddy to tell me it was okay, but Daddy never would say anything. He was just always there. I broke my leg playing football, and he was there. I broke my leg playing basketball, and he was there. I broke my leg playing baseball, and he was always there. Daddy was the first one to put me on a stretcher. I had bad legs, that was obvious. But my daddy was always there. And I wanted him just to talk to me. Peggy and I'd be sitting there talking, and Daddy was sitting in this wheelchair watching. Mother and I had done this for years, and Daddy would just sit. Finally, I looked around and said, Hal, would you like to go out on the sun porch? And he said, Buster, I believe I would. So I rolled him out on the sun porch. Peggy and I were sitting there talking, going back and forth, just like Mom and I did, and Daddy sitting in this wheelchair. Finally, he raised up in the wheelchair, looked me right in the eyes, and he said, son, today you're just like the little boy your Mom and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know who I was, and we buried him a year ago, September, and he never knew who I was again. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me. The miracle is that this drunk said, "Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be." That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. What can I bring to the table? Not what do I get. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of the heart. We feel without touching, we hear without talking, and we love by instinct. For the next few seconds, please share with me the power of the language of the heart. Close your eyes, take the hand of the person next to you if that's what you wish to do, but just be quiet for a few seconds and feel that power. When I could not walk, talk, and chew gum when I came in this program, Father Martin had a tape of 12 steps of AA, and he closed that tape in a way which says for you what I want to tell you. You people are in my thoughts frequently. You will be in my heart, and you will be in my prayers always. I love you from the very bottom of my heart. I thank you for asking me to talk. I thank you for listening to me. Most of all, I thank you in rooms like this that brought me the message that gave me and mine our lives. For those people that I'm seeing again, it's good to see you. For those people that I met for the first time, it's good to meet you. And for those people I didn't get a chance to talk to, we will meet as we trudge this road of happy destiny. Until that time, good night, Godspeed, and thanks again.